will be John Vanderbrooks. John got his PhD in 2006 with advisors Bob Berner and Elizabeth Verba. And he had the distinction, as he told me today, of when he came in, according to Bob, it's going to be Bob's final PhD student. And so that's quite something to be proud of, and we'll probably hear more about that. And then after graduating, he went on to do a postdoc at Arizona State, where he is now in Phoenix. And he'll be telling us about how to develop new proxies for ancient oxygen levels, which sometimes involve tackling and wrestling alligators. Thanks.
Yeah, as Dave said, when I came in, Bob told me I was going to be his last student. And then it turned out I talked to Dana Royer, and Dana Royer told me Bob told him that he was going to be his last student. And Steve Petch was going to be his last student. But it turned out none of us were his last student, but that's okay. He had one even after me. But I was told this was supposed to be a mix of memories and research. So I'll just mix in a few memories as I go along. We heard a lot of people come up here and say that, you know, they really appreciated what an academic environment it was for them, being here at Yale, and how it was, you know, there was all these opportunities here. But I'd have to say, I don't know if you looked at my cohorts, if that would be quite obvious to everybody. This is my office mate for 5 years here, and these people are my wedding, actually. So, but nonetheless, I also took Brian Skinner's geology class in 2002, I think, actually, as a fresh chemistry undergrad in here. So, so what I'm going to talk about today is looking at how changes in the atmosphere, specifically oxygen, through time may have influenced evolution, and how we may be able to back out what oxygen levels may have been in the past. So this is a science paper that Bob and Peter Ward and I published in 2007, which basically summarized all the hypotheses that had to do with oxygen and extinction, or oxygen evolution and extinction over the Phanerozoic. Looking at this list, there's a wide variety of things from diversification, extinction, conquest of land. But the truth is, not a heck of a lot of these are really testable. I mean, they're good correlations, but it's really hard to move towards causation. So I tried to pick one that I thought we could begin to look at, maybe beginning to test the correlation between and maybe move towards causation, and that's insect gigantism. So in the Carboniferous and Permian, as many of you probably know, there were dragonflies with upwards of 3-foot wingspans, Arthropleura upwards of 6 feet long, and these are some of the largest insects, or arthropods in this case, that have existed on land at least over the last 500 million years. But to date, it's mostly been correlational evidence that oxygen was high and that we had these large insects. There's been some suggestions that maybe there's a diffusional mechanism, but there's not a lot of modern evidence to back up that a simple diffusional model explains why increased oxygen levels would lead to insect gigantism. So I took a page from Lee McAllister, Dr. Baumbach mentioned earlier, in his 1970 paper. It said that perhaps the most relevant evidence for looking at the effects of oxygen would be long-term experiments on the effects of abnormally high or low oxygen partial pressures on the living representatives of the many groups which exist today. So I started setting up a rearing facility, which each of these chambers can be set to a different oxygen level and controlled, and reared a series of insects ranging from beetles to cockroaches. Currently we're doing dragonflies. We've drawn fruit flies, grasshoppers, and a whole range of animals. Just going to go through a few really quickly to show you some of the results. When we look at Zaphobus morio, a beetle, it actually shows some of the strongest effects of increasing oxygen on body size. You can see going up from 10% up to 30% at the peak, there's almost a doubling of body size, maximum body mass in Zaphobus. And, you know, say a picture is worth 1,000 words. You can see here one reared in 10%, one in 21%, and one in 30%. But we also see sort of this classic pattern that's going to develop again and again, that when you go above some sort of threshold value, that the negative effects of higher oxygen begin to play a role and affect the development of these animals. And as oxygen increases, we increase the production of ozone and oxide radicals, the amount of cell damage, the amount of DNA damage, and these effects start to accumulate, and we start to see smaller body size as a stress mechanism and protection against these effects. here's just an example of Drosophila melanogaster, which shows a linear response to oxygen increase at least from 7.5 up to 21% on the hypoxic level. They did not look at the hyperoxic levels, but it does show this linear increase. We can summarize all these studies in this somewhat colorful graph here, and what really comes out of all these studies and all these different species is that hypoxia always really strongly affects animals. You can see that almost every group shows a decrease in size under hypoxic conditions. But the responses to hyperoxia are quite varied, but they all generally have this parabolic shape where you see that there's some positive effect of oxygen up to some threshold value, which may be today's value of 21%. You may not even go into hyperoxic conditions. And then above that value, they start to come down, and we see the negative effects come into play. So the question becomes, what mechanism is causing this? What's causing the decrease in hypoxia, and what's causing the potential increases in hyperoxia, and what does this all tell us about the whole insect gigantism story? So the hypoxic story is a little simpler. There's only two ways to get smaller. Either you have smaller cells, or you have less cells. And so we did a study to look at 21 and 10%, and this is just showing you average cell size. And you can see that they have smaller cells in comparison to their counterparts at normoxic levels. So this is the proximal mechanism, this is, you know, the straightforward mechanism. But insects also have a very unique respiratory system, which involves tracheal system. These are hollow air-filled tubes that deliver oxygen directly to the cells. You can see there's a spiracle to the outside air. Air comes in the tube, diffuses down all these pathways through smaller and smaller trachea, down to the tracheoles, which are the smallest ends of the trachea, which deliver oxygen directly to the cell. So the question is, do different oxygen levels affect this tracheal system, and how does that impact oxygen delivery in giant insects? So to look at this, we go to Argonne National Labs, where we use X-ray synchrotron imaging to look at the internal structures of living beetles. You can see here, these tubes are the trachea, all these hollow tubes here and here. And we can do a study on how do the tracheal systems change as insects get larger and insects get smaller. And this brings us to what was known as our tracheal system limitation hypothesis. Due to the possession of a blind-ended tracheal respiratory system, that leads to increasing challenges for gas exchange as insects get larger. Because the insects get larger, they need to have more oxygen in their tissues. Turns out to compensate, which I'll show in the next slides, insects increase their mass-specific investment in the tracheal system and utilize more convection. So as they get bigger, more and more of their body is taken up with this tracheal system, and eventually they hit a maximal limit, as we show here. And then the second counterpart to this argument is that when atmosphere oxygen is higher, the trachea are smaller, and this actually is going to reduce the limit on the body size and allow for the larger development of body size in insects. So explain this in a little more detail. We can see here the trachea in insects of different sizes are beetles. This is a 2 milligram beetle. You can see the tracheal width versus the leg volume there. The trachea is in yellow. The leg is in white. And as we get bigger and bigger coming through this opening, this coccyx into the leg, more and more of the trachea begins to fill that opening until we eventually reach a maximal limit. And we plot the data out here. We can see that as tracheal volume increases the mass to the 1.3, and most strongly affected are the leg trachea, shown here. And if we plot these body lengths versus tracheal densities, and you can see this is the tracheal density in the coxa, which is going to have a maximum value of 1. At 1, the entire coxa is going to be filled with trachea, and no more, you're not going to be able to get any larger. And so if we extrapolate out from the measurements that we have here, where we have body length versus tracheal density, you can see it's a pretty big extrapolation. But it turns out that this value here of around 170 millimeters in body length matches up with the maximum body size of the beetles that we have on Earth today. So it looks like this tracheal density constraint, the fact that as you get bigger, you need more and more trachea in ratio and to body size ratio, is placing a constraint on the maximum body size of insects today. So the corollary to this is, now if we rear a bunch of, this was white and blue on my screen, but anyway, if we rear a bunch of beetles under different oxygen conditions, how does that affect their tracheal to body size ratio? And we can see here we have a nice negative correlation that as oxygen increases, tracheal widths in animals of the same size decrease. And so by decreasing tracheal size in an insect that is at its maximum body size, removes that constraint and allows insects to grow to larger body sizes. And so this points to a possible mechanism for why insects in the Carboniferous and Permian may have been able to get to larger body sizes. They had reduced tracheal investment and were able to overcome that constraint. So when we think about it this way, oxygen isn't really a driver of evolution. It's more placing constraint on what the maximal body size is. Because just because you can get bigger doesn't mean you will get bigger. So there's going to be a bunch of other factors that are involved in that. So if we take all this data, and then we try to take this to the fossil record and think, maybe is there a way that we can reverse this and get what the paleo-oxygen levels were out of the past? And so the first question is, can we even measure trachea in insects in the past, and can we get a tracheal to body size ratio? So we go back to Argonne, and we take all our fossils back to Argonne, and we can see, yes, indeed, an ant is the first fossil we did. These are modern ants. You can see what their trachea look like here. And we can see that we successfully were able to measure trachea in insects preserved in amber, shown here, and shown as a blow-up here. This is actually a beetle, and you can see here the outer leg. You can see the trachea coming down the middle. So unfortunately, we don't have all this data analyzed yet. We have a host of undergrads for analyzing all this data, but we'll be able to hopefully turn this into at least some estimations of what paleo-oxygen levels were in the past and begin to at least pinpoint some times where we have strong amber deposits through the Vanerozoic to start testing these models that are based on non-biological proxies at the moment. So that was just sort of a brief introduction to the research we're talking about, I'm doing now. Also, this is supposed to be focused on future directions, so I sort of wanted to briefly talk about another initiative that I'm involved in starting up. It's developing what we call the Variable Atmosphere Laboratory. So we've heard a lot about how we have sort of these long-standing models, and we need to test these models, and we need to overcome them. But sort of the other aspect of moving science forward, or one of the other aspects, is developing new tools to research new questions. And so we're talking about developing the creation of a large-scale variable atmosphere laboratory, which we nicknamed VAL, that will provide multiple controlled spaces, which we call mini-worlds, within which careful experimental analysis of the interactions among atmospheric and environmental variables and organisms and materials and ecosystems will be possible. So basically, we're creating a series of 83 mini-worlds in which you can control the atmospheric composition, not just oxygen and CO2, so not just what, you know, say the FACE experiments are doing, but a host of trace gases from nitrous oxide to H2S to ozone to VOCs. And we have enough of them that replication is possible. And you can sort of see this artist's conception of what the facility is going to look like here. You have all the mini worlds stacked inside here. You know, your facility's back here. And there's five major areas of research. We have over 110 scientists that have been involved in this project so far. And I'll sort of show you where we are along this. But the five major areas of research we feel this facility would help are ecological processes, physiological processes, paleontology, geology, biogeochemistry, both astrobiology and space exploration, and we have a really strong environmental air quality and human health component. And sort of the advantages of this type of facility over what's out there, when you talk about your large-scale FACE experiments or biosphere or the Ecotron over in France, is really fivefold. We have replication, so we have 83 of them, so you can actually get a statistical sample size and a high enough N that you can actually test some things as opposed to, you know, biosphere, which would have an N of 1. We have the ability to do interaction studies where we can't, not just looking at one variable, not just carbon dioxide or temperature, but looking at a mix of variables. Flexibility, the interior of the spaces that you see in a moment, allow for a wide variety of control, and basic design flexibility allows for setting the interiors however you want. Scale, so some of these are going to be on the order of 40 feet by 40 feet by 30 feet, so very large. So you can do ecosystem studies, long-term geologic weathering studies, and then also monitoring. So not just being able to control, but also the ability to measure fluxes of various atmospheric components in and out, looking at atmospheric chemistry changes, and looking at impacts of organisms and geological materials on these changes. Here's the design of the larger chamber. This is, you can see a person for scale here. So you have some small trees in here, you have your trace gas control here, you have your daylight coming in from the top, as well as air mixing chambers here. And you can see these are pretty complex. We're in the process of doing architectural design right now. These are the smaller ones. These are 14 feet by 14 feet by 14 feet with a 6-foot soil depth. These ones have a higher level degree of control, but obviously on a smaller scale. So these are good for small communities, plants, animals, weathering experiments. It's really a tool to move above and beyond the current facilities that are out there and begin to test some of these climate change predictions and models that have come out there to really get at the questions of how is climate change in the past, present, and future really going to affect organisms and the human impacts on life. They're made from sort of this kit assembly concept where you can put in what you want, take out what you want, and make them all nice and flexible for you guys. There's a research and education component built in here. This is a public facility where we're developing with a number of museums and a number of educational researchers developing the first high-tech climate change exhibit for people to come and visit. Here's our plan for where we're at now. We had the initial, you know, idea and proposal. We've had two NSF-funded workshops, one at ASU and then one in Washington, D.C., where we had all the directors of all the different panels at the workshop. We have a pending MRI proposal to build six mini-worlds for $7.8 million. And then we are moving on to the writing an MREFC proposal for funding for the entire facility and talking to these various associations. So this is sort of an example of a future direction of how we can look at science in new and bigger ways and answer some of these questions that have been burning for a long time. And I just want to sum up with a quick story about some of the other research I did. It involves LEO. When I was here, I actually, instead of rearing insects under different oxygen levels, I actually reared alligators under different oxygen levels. And I ran to LEO in the hall one day, LEO Hickey, and LEO told me, you know, John, I had a nightmare about you last night. He said, I woke up in the middle of the night, and I thought there was a giant alligator that was going to eat me in my bed. And so I just want to point out what I'm working on now, or what I've worked on, is this development of cyborg beetles. And I just want LEO to know that I'm still doing things that should give you nightmares. So...